Juneteenth, also known as Freedom Day, is a blend of the words June and 19th and commemorates the day, June 19th, 1865, when black folks in Texas found out they were free, 2 years after the declaration of the Emancipation Proclamation by President Abraham Lincoln. Joining us to discuss Juneteenth's history is Dr. Kevin Thompson, adjunct professor of the African American Studies Program at the University of Houston. So, Dr. Kevin Thompson, thank you for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So, can you tell me, what is Juneteenth?
Juneteenth is a celebration that's generally celebrated by African Americans here in the state of Texas that commemorates their freedom after the Emancipation Proclamation was announced. That proclamation was issued in 1863, January 1st, by President Abraham Lincoln. And given the fact that Texas was not a battleground state, it took about 2 years for the news to arrive to the people here in Texas that the war was over. And so once they found out that the war was over...
The Civil War, right.
Yeah, the Civil War, right, was over, they were, quote-unquote, freed. But generally, they were not free on the plantation. They were free federally. So locally and the state power... in order for them to get their freedom, they either had to escape or they were freed as a result of Union encroachment upon the land, or the Union soldiers were taking over the property, things like that. So once they took the power away from the plantation owner, the slaves were thereby free.
So are you saying that the slaves were freed, but they had nowhere to go?
Yeah, they really didn't have any place to go. They were free, but that was it. So you have your freedom, yet you don't have a home and all of that. So the whole 40 acres and a mule, you know, was cute, but it wasn't executed at that time.
Or ever.
Ever, right.
Can you explain the difference between the slaves that decided to stay on the plantation and the slaves that went into the systems of sharecropping?
So after decades and decades and decades and generations and generations and generations of being on a particular plot of land, it was hard for some to disassociate themselves from it. And if you have either worked in the house and the master treated you a little differently than you were treated, or as a field slave was treated, excuse me, or if you served as a wet nurse, basically if you nursed somebody else's child, it was a little hard to extract yourself from that environment because that's all you knew. Some people have really lost the will to be free. Now, you forward, sharecropping really occurred after Civil War. And basically what happened is that poor blacks and poor whites and some of the landowners turned into sharecroppers themselves. You made a living off somebody else's land. When harvest came, the landowner could take either half down to a third. That was his share of the crop. All right? So after that, if he was responsible for taking the harvest to market, you know, selling it, getting the money for it, he could come back and say that, hey, we only made X amount of dollars. Here's your portion. Now, ten times out of ten, if you were black, you were not treated fairly within this process. Most of the time, if you were white, you were, and you were able to kind of either buy your land as a result or kind of build some sort of capital. But given the fact you had things like the Black Codes and Jim Crow and other measures to marginalize black people, we really were fighting very hard. So basically, it was just slavery under another name, again, all over again.
So generally, after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, what happened to the slaves?
Generally, what happened to the slaves after it was issued was nothing. You have to keep in mind several things. The Emancipation Proclamation was a presidential decree. It wasn't something that was drafted and issued by Congress. It wasn't passed by Congress. This was something that President Lincoln did of his own volition. And basically what it was used for, it was used to economically damage the southern states, to kind of take the wind out of their sails, if you will, during the war. So once this decree was issued, it basically gave the North the power to go and take the landowner's land or the plantation owner's land, thereby taking his economic vehicle for compensation. And once you have destroyed his economic base, you can change people's political views quite easily.
What were the political views changed to?
Well, the political views were changed to I can't own you as a slave outright. However, you'll sell my property in mind. So while this government, because you have to keep in mind also that the Confederate states were still rebelling against the Union. So they had seceded. They had considered themselves their own nation, their own country. So they looked at the Union as somebody coming into their house and telling them what to do. So they did everything within their power to fight back. So, yes, you issued a decree stating that all slaves within these areas were to be free. But you did this federally. Well, if I don't consider myself a part of your government, then your legislature or your decree means nothing to me.
Well, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, but it was still not the end of the Civil War.
That's right, because it didn't end until 1865. And again, it was just a decree. And it was only a decree because Lincoln had the power as commander-in-chief. But it wasn't a quote-unquote legislative maneuver. It was basically something. It was basically a war tactic.
And when did slaves legally become free?
Well, they legally became free when the 13th Amendment was ratified.
And can you talk about the connection between the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment?
Well, the connection between the 13th Amendment and the Emancipation Proclamation, they were basically related in name. Both stated that slavery had been abolished and that it was no longer right to own another individual as property. However, there was a loophole in the 13th Amendment, and the loophole stated that while you didn't have the right to hold another person as your slave, if this person was incarcerated, then you could use that person or consider that person as a slave. And that's putting it very, very roughly.
And so the backlash after slavery ended, the Jim Crow laws came out of that. Also, convict leasing, you were mentioning, loitering laws as well. Mm-hmm. Can you explain those?
Sure. So after the Emancipation Proclamation was given and slaves were freed, landholders did not want to let their property go that easily. So what they did is that they created these laws or black codes to maintain their control. And basically what it did, it maintained a white supremacist modus operandi. They wanted to keep things as they were previously. So one of the laws stated that as a black person, you cannot walk without being accompanied by a white person. That was one of the previous slave codes. So now you enter in the Emancipation Proclamation. So then now, after this person is free and they're just walking around, either A, looking for a job or looking for their long-lost family members, I could arrest that person for being a vagrant or vagrancy or loitering. And what I could do then is that I could submit them to involuntary labor. I can make them work off their sentence for 3 months or sometimes as long as I wanted to if the person didn't know any better. And then you had other things like laws that were executed within a Jim Crow era in places like Mississippi, in which you had to pass a poll tax or take a poll test, or pay a a poll tax. He had to pay the poll tax, I'm sorry, and pass the literacy test before he can vote. And that was around the early 1900s. So those things like that kind of reestablished white supremacy and slavery. Because keep in mind, Africans have been enslaved here for almost 300 years up until that time. Really 400 years. So you have generation after generation of people who are accustomed to that structure, black and white. So to come in to abruptly shake things up was problematic. So in order to reestablish what was now, we had to pass legislature to reinforce that message.
And do you think it's possible for America to exist without some form of slavery?
I think so. I don't think any person have to or has to be subjected to another in order for things to work. Now, I do think there is an order to things. Not everyone has the acumen or the experience to lead, quote unquote. But I don't believe that one's skin color dictates that.
And part of the reason why I ask is because racial tensions are ripe in the U.S. right now under the current administration. And mm-hmm. even here in liberal, quote unquote, California, there are many alt-right and white supremacist groups here. But mm-hmm. the world saw in 2017 the alt-right marching in Charlottesville.
Right.
And the battles that have been around bringing Confederate statues down. And this is shortly after electing the first black president. So what are your thoughts about this new backlash in America and the racial tensions after Obama?
Well, I think the misconception is that it's a new backlash. It's old. It hasn't stopped. That particular facet of society has not stopped promoting its agenda. So it's not an old thing. It's a new thing. It's just packaged a little differently.
So you see hope in America's racial tension somehow being worked out?
You have to remain hopeful. I see hope. I think that black people are getting their things together. We've just been destitute for so long that we have our priorities messed up in some regard. But I think we're getting our things together. I think we're working out, especially black women. Black women are really doing a marvelous job of getting educated and coming together and really showing black men what you should do once you attain a level of freedom. Unfortunately, we live in a misogynistic country. But I do think that conversations like the one that we're having are working to work out the kinks. I'm of the mindset that some things can be solved with a simple talk. If people will put down their rhetoric and just sit at the table with someone they either don't know, don't understand, or don't like and have a conversation, a very pointed conversation, a lot of things can work out. But what you have is that you have people who are literally scared to talk face to face with another person because there's no protection there. I can't hide behind a flag or I can't hide behind an ideology. And it forces one to be human. And I think humanity, this common human thread, is the one thing that breaks down the hardest barrier.
Do you think this has to do with our education in this country? Because so little, even we're just talking about Juneteenth, there's so little information on the subject. It's not taught in schools. We don't know as much about it as Black History Month or even Kwanzaa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one thing is that when you look at these advisory boards and these editorial boards of textbooks here in the States, a lot of times they're very milquetoast, very white. Meaning that there is a Eurocentric perspective to American history. But if you were to ask the slave or the descendants of the slaves the same questions, we'll talk about those particular subjects, you would get a different purview. So the reason why things are very, very white within American education is because American education is dominated by white people. So I'm going to tell history from my perspective. That's the beautiful thing and the ugly thing about history is that I can tell my truth and disregard yours simultaneously. So if I'm telling it from my perspective, your perspective really doesn't matter. And I don't have to include it. And I can leave out or add whatever I choose because you don't have the power to influence that.
So let's talk a little bit about the migrations, the Negro migrations of black folks from slaveholding southern states. The first, after the Civil War, was roughly 1916 into 1930 when black folks left for the North, New York City. The second migration was 1940s to 1970s, black folks, and that's my family, left to come out west to California. People say that black folks moved from the South for opportunity.
Right.
But you also said they left because of brutality that they faced post-Civil War. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So let's go back to the first migration, the migration of blacks to the North. We have to look at the war. World War One was going on at the time. And since we were fighting Europeans, there was a major stop to the human capital needed to make and to manufacture the things needed for the war. Since blacks had been freed and were still looking for work or farming a little bit here and there, these manufacturers needed bodies. So they started to entice and encourage blacks to move north. And one story I read, it was my family went to Chicago and my wife's family moved to Erie, that in the steel mills, the whites could not work close to the furnace because they would get overwhelmed with the heat. They couldn't take it due to the lack of melanin in their skin. And those who worked closer to the smelter or the furnace made more money. So blacks were encouraged to work that position. Now, it was hard and it was dangerous, but given the amount of melanin within our skin, we could withstand more heat. So what led to another point of contention was the fact that blacks were making more money than whites. So what happened as a result of that is that those whites who were quote-unquote disenfranchised by the color of their skin became the supervisor to those who could withstand the heat. Okay, and again, that's another conversation. So you have something similar to that happened within the second migration from the 40s to the 70s with the blacks moving from the southern states to the west. You have to keep in mind that while slavery wasn't a thing in the North, racism was still prevalent. In some cases, even worse. So now you go from those jobs kind of drying up around the 40s. You're talking now the Second World War, and we're fighting the Asians now and the other homeboys and homegirls, you know. And the jobs have shifted from just making metal and smelting and, you know, this big industrial revolution, this big boom in the North, they're shifting to the West with the shipyard building and ship making, things like that. They needed bodies. So, of course, they enticed blacks to move there. So they say, well, you know, racism is really not a big thing here. You know, come on out here and make you a little money and we'll take care of you. But again, once you put people in the same place who have similar experiences, because it wasn't just blacks who moved out there, whites moved too. And they brought their attitudes with them. So that was those were the primary reasons for the migrations.
Well, there seems to be a return of black folks from the North and from the West back to the South for land and other resources. What are your thoughts on why that's happening now?
You know, cost of living is lower, and depending on where you are, I can't speak for every place. I'm just speaking from my personal experiences, but land is generally lower. The taxes are lower. You get more bang for your buck, more house for your buck, and things like that. And then a lot of those families managed to keep their land. You know, even though they went through all of the hell, they managed to keep their land. And land is very important to the African. It's very important to the African. It's something that you not only can make a living off of and survive off of, but your spirit is actually intertwined within the soil.
One of the consequences of both of those migrations was that we went from having a relationship with the land to being more urban dwellers. Mm-hmm. So we live more in cities now, and so we don't have that connection. I can say that my grandmother knew a lot about farming, but I don't. And that right. that information got lost through generations.
Right. And what happened is that, you know, life sped up. You know, we had to adjust to the hustle and bustle of the city. And man really wasn't meant to live in housing. You know, now I don't want to say housing. Let me take that back. And in the housing that we were, quote unquote, associated with the ghetto, with the project and things like that. The land takes care of the people when the people take care of the land. And you always grow a relationship with things that you take care of. So when you have other entities taking care of things, you know, in the cities, we have maintenance crews and janitorial crews and things like that, taking care of the outside and making sure that things are manicured and working order. There's little relationship to it. There's little connection with it. As opposed to if you grew up on a farm or within a farming community, or you just grew up around a lot of land, there's something to be said about that, the connection between yourself and the land. And a lot of those traditions were lost during the migration because you didn't have to do it anymore. As opposed to the South, while not everybody can farm and hunt and fish and so on and so forth, a lot of those traditions were passed down, or at least you saw it in action a time or two. So you were familiar with it. And even if you weren't familiar with it, you know where to find the information or someone who could share the information with you.
So it's believed that Texas folks took the celebration of Juneteenth to Oakland and Seattle and spread it among other Black folks nationwide. Is that your assessment as well?
That's my sense as well. Yeah, pretty much. You know, once they started to kind of move to other states, yeah, they took the tradition with them.
And why would you say Juneteenth is still relevant in terms of our history here in America to slave descendants today?
Well, I think it's still relevant because the final 250 to 500,000 brothers and sisters who were enslaved finally got the news that we weren't slaves anymore, that we had been freed and we were released, and we are released and free to be men and be women and to do our own thing. It's still relevant because it's a monument to the lag of information and to the lack of empathy that the American society has shown the African American. And we celebrate this because even after all of this poor and disparate treatment, we are still here and we are still thriving.
Dr. Kevin Thompson, thank you for speaking with me today.
And thank you for having me, Janine. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
Yes, sir. That was Dr. Kevin Thompson, adjunct professor of the African American Studies program at the University of Houston, speaking about the culture and history of the Juneteenth celebration.